16th, 2015, and we're going to open with a work session on House Bill 2908.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2908, you heard back in February and again in early March. This is bringing Oregon in compliance with H.R. 4980, passed by Congress, which is the Federal Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act of 2015. You have the Dash 1 amendments, which make some clarifying changes, and we have the fiscal and revenue statements back on it. It is a minimal fiscal and no revenue. It is ready to go.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2908.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2908. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2908 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2908 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Again, is there any discussion of the bill? Are there any objections? The motion, hearing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry that? Anybody?
Oh, thank you.
Isn't it Ann's bill?
Representative
Olson.
It's Ann's bill. Representative Leininger's bill.
Representative Leininger will carry the bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2647.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2647 is Representative Williamson's bill. It is the Privacy Expectations Afterlife and Choice Act, and it requires a court order for access to a deceased user's digital records. You have three amendments in front of you, the proposed Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 3. The proposed Dash 1 amendments provide an avenue for disclosure of contents by a service provider if all of the court order requirements have been met, and the will and testament of the deceased user or the internal settings on a digital account provide for disclosure. The proposed Dash 2 amendments clarify that copyright laws exist for disclosures, as they did for the content of the user. And the proposed Dash 3 amendments make disclosure of the record mandatory if all of the requirements are met. In the currently drafted bill, it is permissive.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having this hearing today. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36. I just wanted to take a second for us to think about how the way we communicate has changed in the last 20 years. I remember sending my first email in 1995 and how awesome it was in this kind of binary computer that was ginormous. And I think about how much things have changed since then. I did a quick survey online to figure out the fastest growing communications apps in 2013, and they were Vine, Flickr, WhatsApp, Skype, YouTube, Twitter, Foursquare, and Facebook Messenger. I had to actually look up what some of them are, actually, because I'm not that hip. In 2014, the fastest growing app was Snapchat, and it wasn't even on the list in 2013. There was a study recently about teenagers and how they communicate. 63% of them said they use text messages to communicate every single day, and compared with 39 who say they make and receive cell phones calls and on a daily basis. And so I can't imagine if they had asked these teenagers if they had used a landline what the answer would be. In our house, we don't have a landline. We only have cell phones. Millennials are also living up to their description as digital natives. An overwhelming 81% of millennials are on Facebook, and their average friend count is 250. And it seems with every generation, or I would argue every year, we seem to be documenting and sharing our thoughts, experiences, and personal information online in a way that we couldn't have even guessed when I sent that email 20 years ago. And so as a result, the average internet user will end up with a significant digital history, an online catalog of private communications that simply would not have existed, like I said, 20 years ago, including instant messages between friends, emails to and from significant others, messages through an online dating site, or an email to a healthcare provider. And colleagues, you know that since I arrived here last session, I have worked on a variety of bills that I believe are important in protecting Oregonians' privacy. And I think that this bill is part of that, of the packages of bills that I have brought in the past. We have an issue that's of growing concern about what happens with our digital communications upon our death. Unless it's necessary to close an estate, I believe communication should not be disclosed simply because we are no longer around as individuals to keep them private. As we do more and more of our business online, our catalog or our digital footprint may also include things like financial information that is necessary to close a person's estate. But it's fundamentally different than what we usually think of as a box of letters or documents in a safe or in a shoebox under a bed or in a closet. This shift to online communications and storage means that it's absolutely necessary for fiduciaries or next of kin executors to gain access to certain digital records, but I believe not to all of them. This bill provides access while making sure the default for our entire footprint online is kept private and that we err on the side of privacy for the individual as opposed to opening up this ever-growing digital world of ours to our executors or our next of kin. I believe that we have a right to privacy both before and after death, and our lifetime of digital communications are fundamentally different than that box of letters under the bed. So with that, I would urge you to pass this bill today, and we'll have Representative Shamia Fagan is with me to talk about her own personal experience with this issue.
Thank you, Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. But I'm really testifying today just on a very personal note with some testimony that I think is very timely and relevant to this conversation. As most of you know, I lost my mom 5 days before the election. And in an effort to, she was a Facebook user. And so in an effort to, there's some cool websites where you can go on and create a book of people's Facebook pages. And my mom would definitely express lots of joy and how happy she was in life through her Facebook. And so I wanted to create a book of these for my family. And I happened, because I had set up her Facebook for her, I happened to have her password. So I went in and logged into her Facebook after she had passed and ended up in her private messages and definitely saw information that I would not have want to seen, that I don't think I know for a fact she would not have want me to see. And it felt very much like I was violating her privacy. It very much felt like I was, you know, this was just communications between her and like a friend. Definitely was not something she ever anticipated having somebody else read. It was basically, to me, the equivalent of kind of a late night phone call with somebody that, you know, you think about, and then being able to have your family members go back and know everything that you said in a late night phone call. So when I heard that Representative Williamson was bringing this bill, I said, oh, yeah, I'm very supportive, because I happened to have my mom's password, so that situation was different. But if I hadn't had it, this is fundamentally different than finding a box of letters that she had intentionally put to writing. I think that in the world of instant messenger and Facebook messaging and Google chat and these things, I think that people do treat these types of messaging services a lot like a phone call. And so the idea is that I think they should be treated with privacy, and I don't think that there's any reason why people should be able to go in. I just wanted to offer my own experience as somebody who, you know, read things I wouldn't have wanted, didn't want to read, and certainly, you know, kind of embarrassed for her that I saw those things, which is not how you want to remember someone. And so yeah, I just offer that as kind of a personal testimony that I concur very much in Representative Williamson's thought that these are fundamentally different than a box of letters under the table. Even though there are technically writings and documents in the legal sense, I think that we should protect them posthumously and make sure that folks' privacy stays intact even after they're gone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just would comment and thinking about this a bit. So some of these things you write, you're joking around, and they're funny at the time. And if somebody's reading them 5 or 10 years later, it's out of context. It isn't funny. I mean, it could be, you know, very abrasive when it would be completely misunderstood. So.
Mr. Chair, are you thinking about some of your emails?
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I was just going to note that sometimes I don't think that you're funny even 5 minutes after you said it. So I can certainly imagine.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
This may not be the time to ask this question, but my understanding is there are two competing approaches to how to deal with this. Would you?
Well, we have a whole room full of people who are going to compare the two approaches.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your
testimony. Not your comments, your testimony. I appreciate it.
Strike that comment.
I think she wants to go past her.
Call Rebecca Ball, Jeff Novak, and Kimberly McCullough.
I don't have to worry about it.
And you can go in any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Backer, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Ball, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Yahoo in support of House Bill 2647 with the -1, -2, and -3 amendments. This bill relates to how executors can get, or fiduciaries can get access to digital assets when closing an estate. And a digital asset is an online communication, an iMessage, a GChat, a social media message, an email. So a core principle behind this bill is that it recognizes that not all digital assets are traditional assets. A traditional asset might be an email that you receive from a financial institution or an accountant that is much like a letter that you receive from a financial institution or accountant. But many digital assets are private. They are conversations that you have with friends and family or colleagues over text message, over email, over social media, that are private. And these are types of conversations that 20 years ago would have happened face-to-face or over the phone in a medium that was not recorded and stored. So if you took a poll of your friends and family, like I have, you might find that they expect for their traditional assets to be turned over to their executor. They have a relationship with this financial institution. But they would not expect that every private conversation they had over iMessage or GChat or Facebook message would be given over to their executor. So that's an important part of this proposal before you today. So here to talk more about it is Jeff Novak from American Online, who will talk about how this relates to federal law. Kimberly McCullough from the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, who will talk about privacy expectations. Carl Szabo from NetChoice, who will go through how the bill actually works. And then Anne Blackwood from Facebook and Darcy Nothnagel from Google, who will talk about tools that online service providers are making available to their users so they can make choices as to what happens in their digital afterlife. So I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Good afternoon. Jeff Novak. I've been an in-house lawyer at AOL for a dozen years. I manage our compliance function, our litigation function, and our public policy function. I've been representing the company for 17 or 18 years, and a recurring issue in my litigation portfolio is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. ECPA was passed by Congress in 1986, and it reflected something that remains true, which is that people use electronic communications in the same manner that they use the telephone. In fact, millennials tend to use it in lieu of telephony. We're the oldest email service provider. We've been in business for 30 years. We're actually older than ECPA. And I've got among our 22 million domestic email users, former presidents and celebrities. I've got plenty of folks who communicate in confidence. And federal law secures an expectation of confidentiality. I can tell you international law actually raises it to the level of a human right that you have an expectation of confidentiality in your electronic communications. What ECPA does is it, to put it rather simply, it prohibits us from disclosing your communications unless I've got either actual consent, meaning the consent of the actual user, or a search warrant. I have a team of five who work full-time handling the request for user information and contents that we get from law enforcement, from the FISA court, from private litigants, and it's a very tightly managed area. The reason being is that we have with every one of the tens of thousands of requests that we get the potential for a lawsuit, because what ECPA does is it says that anybody, not just our user, but the people in whom our users confide and the people who confide in our users, any person aggrieved by virtue of a violation of ECPA can sue us for actual damages, punitive damages, and attorney's fees. I know from painful experience this to be the case. Like a lot of other things in our industry space, we pioneered a lot of the early ECPA litigation. We've got a number of reported cases. We've had cases where we've been misled by law enforcement, for example, into revealing information on the pretext of a warrant that was never presented to a court. That was the Friedman case, which was litigation in the Eastern District of Virginia. We've had a case where we had a technology officer who posted in an academic site anonymized and de-identified search queries, and we were sued for violating ECPA. Again, even though those were de-identified and anonymized. So this is an area that we manage very tightly. As I said, we cannot give content over unless we've got consent or we have a search warrant. For subscriber information or records information, what would be the equivalent of a PIN register, for example, at a phone company, a record showing that a call was made from number X to number Y at a particular time, there's lesser protection because the content of that communication is not in that record. That's just a transactional record. The equivalent for us would be IP address X, IP address Y, time and date. We're permitted to release that information to the government upon issuance of a subpoena or a court order. What we've done with this, with the Peace Act, is we've tried to solve for a very discrete issue. And it's an issue that the alternate bill actually started with 3 years ago, but it ended up in a very different place. The discrete issue is just ensuring that a personal representative who's settling somebody's estate doesn't have a blind spot if somebody's gone paperless. I've gone paperless with most of my accounts. If you were to look at my email, you would see regular emails from Amex, from Bank of America, from Fidelity, and so forth. But you wouldn't actually see in the contents of those communications what's necessary to settle the estate. In fact, for financial privacy reasons, Graham Leach Bliley and other things, the financial service company will have you credential into their server. So you have a link, typically, in that. You won't even have the entirety of the account number. What we've done in our proposal is we've enabled personal representatives to obtain what we call envelope information. And that envelope information would be the to and from. And the to and from would reflect in the event that of my death, for example, my wife, who will be my personal representative, would see that I get regular emails from these financial companies. She would then be able to send her letters of administration off to those entities to inventory and to settle those accounts that I've got. She would not, however, be able to get the contents of my electronic communications unless I had consented, again, consistent with ECPA. I could consent by way of a will provision. Many T&E practitioners are now including such provisions in the wills that they draft for their clients. You could also consent by way of an election that a service provider provides. All providers are very different in this regard. I can tell you in our business, again, we have 20-some million domestic email users. We have in our legacy business a subscription arrangement whereby it's typically a family arrangement where we have up to 7 users on an account. We've been managing account succession issues, for example, joint use of a husband and wife. We've been managing that for 30 years without issue. We have a free email subscription service, which is more akin to what you would get from, say, Yahoo or Google. And there's, in the event of inactivity after so much time, the emails simply disappear off the servers. So, again, different providers are different, but what this proposal does is it enables, again, a specific solution to that blind spot problem. And it does it in a way that doesn't subject providers to the awful choice of having to say, I'm going to disregard state law because of the Supremacy Clause issue with regard to the federal obligations. It doesn't invite litigation, which would drive up the cost of estate administration. And I think, frankly, in a most fundamental way, it doesn't create the sort of heartache that the alternate proposal would do by affording blanket access. This is a 20-state playing field for us this year. I've spent an awful lot of time over the last month in Virginia, where our proposal got through the House and the Senate on unanimous votes just 2 weeks ago. The chair of the House Courts Committee there said, you know, his children are adopted. He wouldn't care for his children to learn, only in the event of his death by virtue of being a personal representative, to learn things out of the email that he had chosen not to share with them. We can imagine situations in which people might be outed posthumously. They might have lived a closeted lifestyle by choice. I use the example of former presidents, so you can imagine, for example, had President Reagan had an email account, I think two of the kids might well have wished to sell that off. The more scandalous, the better. I'm pretty sure the third would have been mortified at that prospect. Again, the use of communication services like telephony is not, we don't do this with the idea that this is going to see the light of day. I have a box of letters that I keep that I wish for my children to read in the event of my death. If I do a good job on an AG task force and somebody writes me a nice note, that goes into my letterbox. But that's not how I use text messaging, and it's certainly not how I use email. And our proposal recognizes as much and protects that expectation.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. In today's digital world, when we pass away, we leave behind a huge amount of information electronically, and that's why the ACLU of Oregon is supportive of this bill, because it provides protection for that information, as has been discussed already. I want to give you a few examples of the type of information that you may not share with your family or the rest of the world, but that you might have just shared with a few people, and that would be revealed if they were granted blanket access. You may have been experiencing an addiction to alcohol or drugs, and you may have been seeking treatment for that addiction. That's the kind of thing that you may just not want people to know after you die. You might have sought advice from a spiritual advisor or from a religious advisor. That's the kind of information that is really between a person, those two individuals, and they may not want to share that information. Similarly, you could have a mental health condition, or a physical condition, or a medical condition, or you may have political beliefs that you hold pretty close to your heart. Again, also you could be LGBT and not open about that. So those are just some examples. We're in support of this bill, and I'd like to also just point out we're in support of this bill with all three of the amendments. The three amendments are essential to our support, in large part, that's because, in particular, the Dash 2 amendment really has to do with the user controls rather than this being in the terms of service. I just wanted to note that. So Carl Szabo is going to provide more information about and details about the bill, but I just want to highlight a few reasons why the ACLU supports it. As noted before, digital records are very different from physical records. Consumers don't expect other people to access their online accounts. They just don't expect that at all. And so we should honor that expectation even after a person passes away. In addition, consumers deliberately share some information with a large number of users. You can think about when you're on Facebook and you get into your privacy controls and you can say, oh, I'm only sharing this with one person, I'm only sharing it with this group of people, or I'm just sharing it with everyone. And so because there's all these different types of information, we should be able to control that, how each of those different types of information is shared. And sometimes people have information online that no one else sees. And a couple of examples of that, if you use any sort of online photo databases where they actually hold your photos, like Flickr, you can set your settings on there. And I do this for myself. It's a great way to keep my digital photos without having to have them on my computer. But I set them so that I'm the only person who can see them, right? And I have a lot of photos that are personal that I wouldn't necessarily want other people to see. In addition, there's a online service called LiveJournal, and it's sort of like it replaces having an actual physical journal. You can set your settings on there so it's just you. I have a private journal online. It's my journal. Nobody else sees that. And so that's the type of situation where you know, we should respect that expectation. This bill gives users their autonomy. It gives them the ability to make these decisions, and they can do that through user controls, but they can also do it through an estate plan. And so that's really good because it gives some options. It also sets privacy as the default. That means you don't have to do something to get your information private. You have to do something to share it, and that honors our expectations.
It also requires certainty that the records that are disclosed are indeed those of the deceased. So that's a very important safeguard. And I'd like to emphasize also that this is not just protecting the privacy of the person who has died. It's protecting the privacy of anybody that they talked about in their communications. Maybe they talked about things in their live journal, for example, that person shared with them that they wouldn't have shared with somebody else. It may also be that they had an intimate relationship with someone and they shared information with them about their relationship, and that person is still alive. So they're also a party to that communication. So it's extremely important to honor that as well. This bill is also, I want to emphasize, it's limited to the records of people who are deceased as opposed to people who are subject to a conservatorship. My understanding is that the alternative involves that. So when someone is subject to a conservatorship, they may have lost some ability to handle their own financial affairs or other aspects of their lives. But that doesn't mean that that individual doesn't also still have some right to privacy. They may have some communications with somebody else that are not related to those things. And within their ability and their capacity to communicate, they should be able to have those types of private conversations without, you know, conservatorships are already a huge imposition on someone's autonomy. But there should be some limitation with that. So for all of those reasons, the ACLU supports this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, because there are three different amendments, really one of which seems to have a lot of meat, and if you don't know the answer to this, feel free to punt it to somebody else. But on page 2, line 39 and 40 of the bill as written, not the amendments, it talks about a computing service or remote service cannot be compelled to disclose any record or information about a deceased user if, and then 39 and 40 is, if the agreement to the terms of the terms of the service are inconsistent with disclosure to the requesting party, that is to say, i.e., in the contract of adhesion, basically the company could get around it. Now, in your testimony, I think you said that in the dash 2 amendments that language is removed. I think it might be removed in the dash 1, but is in fact that being removed?
Oh, excuse me, it may be dash 1.
It is being removed.
It is the dash 1. I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
But somewhere in there, that line is being removed, correct? Because that opens up a can of worms, I'd say.
Correct. Yeah. So the amendments aim to make plain that this is a mandatory disclosure, not a permissive disclosure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Committee. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you for your time.
Let's call Carl Szabo, Ann Blackwood, and Darrell. I'm sorry, Darcy Northnagel. Northnagel. Something like that. And again, go in any order you'd like, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carl Szabo. I am policy counsel for NetChoice. We're an e-commerce trade association. And I personally have been working on this issue for about 3 years now. And going back to one of the points that my colleague from the ACLU made was the importance of privacy. Now, if your fiduciary were and everyone's fiduciary were a sworn in trust in a state's attorney abiding by code of conduct, court sanctions, and eminently fluent with the penalties for violating that trust, then I think the privacy concern would be lower. But unfortunately, 60 to 70% of Americans die intestate. I'm one of those people who is intestate right now. That's somebody without a will. That means that when I die, since I have a relatively simple estate, the court will most likely turn to my wife and say, you take care of disposition. That's where the privacy concerns for us get really elevated, because more often than not, it's going to be a family member or next of kin that is responsible for the disposition of that estate. So we looked at a couple different ways to address the blind spot that Mr. Novak addressed with respect to fiduciaries finding where the money is. There are two obvious ways to do it: don't do anything or disclose everything. And we recognized neither of those approaches were the right ones. So we sat down, industry, the ACLU, EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Center for Democracy and Technology, and we tried to create a compromise legislation, and that's what you see emboldened and embodied in HB 2647. Now, what does it do? Well, it does a couple of things. One, by default, with the amendments negative 1, negative 2, and negative 3, or dash 1, dash 2, dash 3, depending on how you look at them, by default, once a court has determined that the individual is deceased, that they own the account in question, there are no other active users because we need to protect the privacy of active users, then by default, a service provider, AOL, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, et cetera, will be required, shall disclose the records of communication. So as Mr. Novak explained, if you were to look at my records, you would see every month I have an email from Wells Fargo, from Visa, from MasterCard, and from Verizon. And my next of kin could then get on the phone with Visa, MasterCard, Wells Fargo, and Verizon and close out the estate and have the money transferred. So those records will be disclosed by default and will be required. When it comes to the electronic communications, that's the inside of the envelope, that's the really sensitive information, then the bar goes up, as it should, because we're talking about very private communications. And what we do is we maintain the existing default of privacy, that you can feel safe and secure that the electronic communications, that the instant messages, tweets, voicemails, and other forms of electronic communications that you send today will remain private, unless you put in your will or you use an express statement through a user choice mechanism that you want that information disclosed. Finally, one of the things that we addressed was the situation of, well, what if you put it in the trash can but don't actually delete it? Because I don't know if you're like me, you probably have about 4,000 emails just sitting in the trash that haven't actually been expunged. Well, putting something in the trash or making an inclination that you don't want this communication shared or deleted, well, then the service provider can continue to keep that information private. So after we looked at the issue, you know, it's all well and good for us to sit in a quote-unquote ivory tower in some office building. We wanted to know what registered voters actually want. So Zogby Analytics, Commissioner of Poll nationwide, that actually found 5-1, nearly 5-1, support the approach in the PSAC. 70% of registered voters want their information private unless they expressly consent to disclosure. And then we went a little bit into some greater detail. 43% want it deleted at death, and 30% want it only shared with express consent. We made all these polling results, including crosstabs, available at the website netchoice.org/afterlife. You don't have to remember that. It's in my testimony, and I would welcome you to take a look. So that's what HB 2647 does. It looks at a situation, the needs of the fiduciary to wrap up the estate, gives them the tools they need, the records, but recognize more often than not those fiduciaries are next of kin, and therefore the privacy that users expect, that registered voters have expressed they want, is now respected, and this compromise legislation is the one that we have before you. And I welcome any questions that you have about the Peace Act or any of the polling results or any of my experiences dealing with this issue for the past 3 years.
Would you like me to wait for the panel to finish? No problem.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Ann Blackwood with Facebook. I think the important thing to remember about this bill is that it honors the choices that people have made about what they do and do not want shared. At Facebook, the way we handle this is if someone passes away, we'll memorialize the account. And what that means is that the word remembering will go in front of the name, and then their biographical information reverts to past tense. So it'll say, Ann Blackwood worked at Facebook, and in front of my name, it'll say, Remembering Ann Blackwood. And when an account is memorialized, we keep the person's privacy settings intact. So if I've said, I want my mom and my dad, and I want these people I work with to see this information, but I really don't want them to see that information, those settings stay in place after the person has passed away. We've also additionally launched another tool called Legacy Contact. So now you can go into your security settings on Facebook and designate that you want someone else who you know to manage your account after you die. So that person will have limited access to your existing content. They'll be able to post like a memorial post at the top of, you know, a pinned at the top of your page. So just a remembrance. So it goes on to become a memorial page as well. The person, you also have the choice to just say, I want all my stuff deleted when I die, right? I don't want anyone to manage my account. I want to remove my online presence on Facebook. So what we're trying to do is deal with a very difficult problem and make choices appropriate to the people who are on our service and make sure that they get the choice and that those choices not to have certain pieces of information revealed after they die are not overridden, as I understand they may be in an alternative vehicle. So thank you so much. We urge your support for the bill.
Yes. How do you know if they've died?
So that's an excellent question. We have nearly 1.4 billion people on Facebook now, right? So if someone contacts us and they provide us a copy of an obituary, death certificate, something like that, then we'll go ahead and memorialize an account. But we don't want to make the opposite mistake of accidentally memorializing someone who's being, you know, if they have a friend or someone who knows them who's being a trickster. And, you know, we wouldn't want to have a Mark Twain situation where the rumors of someone's death are, you know, exaggerated. So we don't actively go through every single account to, you know, to figure out, you know, and send them a message saying, are you still alive? Right? So it's a very challenging situation, but if someone notifies us that someone has passed away, then we'll go ahead and memorialize the account according to their current privacy settings. And we're trying to shift to a world where increasingly people will designate what they want to have happen to their account after they pass away. But quite frankly, it's a new problem for us as much as it's a new problem for everyone else. And we've been doing a lot of active work on this issue to try to handle it the appropriate way.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darcy Nothnagel, and I'm here on behalf of Google. Just to follow on some of the testimony that you've heard here today, Google is committed to the privacy of its users, and we're also committed to making sure that our users are empowered to make decisions about what happens to their data. And so to that end, we've created a tool called Inactive Account Manager, and that is a tool that you can find in your settings. So just like when you go into your regular settings in your, perhaps if you have a Gmail account and you want to choose an out-of-office responder to let folks know that you're on vacation, or you want to change the font that's used in your email signature, you'll also, under those settings, find the Inactive Account Manager. And there you can designate what happens to your data in the event that you should pass away. More than that, though, with Google, your Inactive Account Manager can discern, you can sign up for different levels of privacy. So you can say that, for example, my Gmail would go to my husband upon my death, but access perhaps to my social media, my Google Plus posts, maybe my daughter would maintain control of that data. So there's a high degree of user choice in there. And I think what's important for us is that this bill that's being considered respects the choices that users are making, and that for those who haven't made a choice about what happens to their data, it creates a pathway for executors to finalize the closing of an estate without compromising the privacy of the deceased or of the third parties with whom the deceased has communicated. So I'll leave it at that because I know you've heard a lot this afternoon, but thank you for your time.
Okay, Representative Martin. Mr. Chair, and I'd like to thank our colleague, Representative Williamson, for bringing a genuinely fascinating issue before this committee. I enjoy this way too much. But, sir, I had a question for you, and in your testimony, I just want to make sure I understand how this would work. You mentioned, for example, about the will, what if I were to put it. Now, if I'm not mistaken, even if that the bill as written would be, we'd still have to go to court and get a court order authorizing disclosure of the records, just provided it's not inconsistent with the will, correct? You couldn't just by authorizing disclosure in your will and testament avoid the probate process. Is that right?
That's correct. Now, that was one of the things that, you know, we sat down and spent a lot of time trying to figure out. And by go-to court, it's not really the Perry Mason scenario that a lot of us envision. It's more of a ministerial procedure. And the reason that that was necessary is a couple reasons. One, when it comes to electronic communications, as has been described earlier, it's incredibly sensitive and very personal. Second of all, we need to ensure that the account is truly the one to which the deceased owns. So, for example, I have MickeyMouse1234 at AOL.com. Please don't use that. Now, the concern would be that the privacy of Mr. MickeyMouse12345 would be exposed if that information were just incorrectly presented. So the reason for the court double check is to make sure that that disclosure is appropriate. We tried to make the burden as low as possible, but including the necessary privacy restrictions for the sensitivity of the information.
Follow up, please. A comment and then a totally different question for you. Thank you for the response. And just some mild pushback, politely, it is possible that this compromise perhaps has a California-centric view of probate law. In Oregon, we have a fairly high transaction cost system. And indeed, the entire purpose, for example, with me and my wife, perhaps like you, I don't have children. I have a relatively simple estate. The reason why the entire purpose of the estate planning exercise in Oregon, anyway, is for me to avoid probate, because it's a fairly unpleasant process here, something I'd like to deal with in a different bill. But changing topics somewhat, and I don't think this has changed in any of the amendments, although it's a fairly complicated, intricate series of amendments, so I wouldn't mind seeing an engrossed version if we could. But on page 2, line 31 and 32, it's the undue burden provision.
Yes.
Is that ringing a bell? Now, undue burden is it's the classic catch-all phrase when we're trying to give the court discretion, it seems like. It can mean a lot of different things in a lot of different contexts. Did you just mean that in this term as basically just kind of the general give the courts that equitable discretion, or did you have something in mind?
So thank you for the question. With respect to just the issue writ large, just mm-hmm. taking one quick step back, that even though these devices are so integrated to our lives, it's important to just take a moment and remember that the iPad is about to celebrate its 5th anniversary, the iPhone 8 years, and Google's not even old enough to vote. So we are a relatively infant industry. In fact, the old guy in the room is AOL, and he's only 30. So we are moving very quickly, as you heard from Facebook and Google, to introduce new tools to allow users to make these choices. So that aside, with respect to the undue burden question, that was in there just as kind of a safety net. So with respect to the undue burden of disclosure, that is an incredibly high bar for something like this. So for example, if the undue burden is if the issue of disclosure of contents is, let's say, 100 gigabytes and a matter of 7 keystrokes, I'm not going to say the court is not going to consider that an undue burden. However, in my legal opinion, I would find it highly unlikely that that would necessarily constitute an undue burden. It's kind of a catch-all for the scenario of, let's say, Kim.com saying, I want everything at Meta Cloud or whatever server he has, his 8,000 terabytes of information to be disclosed. Something like that.
You know, just a follow-up comment, really, for purpose of legislative history. You know, I'll pass, Mr. Chair. Let me bake that a little better so that the Court of Appeals appreciates my comments more.
Or ignores one of the other.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Thank you, panel, very much.
Thank you.
Next we'll call Victoria Blatchley, Jeffrey Cheney, and Lane Shetterly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here before you today. My name is Lane Shetterly. Today, I'm here in my capacity as a commissioner from Oregon to the Uniform Law Commission. In that capacity, I was a member of the drafting committee of the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. which is the other bill that's sort of the shadow in the room right now that we've heard in testimony. It's Senate Bill 369. And I say that with no intent to turn this hearing into a hearing on UFADA, the Uniform Act. But I do think it's important, and you've heard it from the proponents of the bill already, that this bill before you today, House Bill 2647, really came about in response to the drafting of UFADA. So I just want to start a little bit with that history, and then let me get into Senate Bill or House Bill 2647. The construct or the basis from which UFADA was born was the recognition, just as Representative Williamson said, that more and more we are migrating our property from the old-fashioned bricks and mortar and safe deposit boxes and strong boxes on the shelf in our offices at home into the Internet and the various permutations of the Internet. We are unfortunately still in the dark ages when it comes to the means by which we manage those assets in the context of estates, of conservatorships, of trusts, and to some lesser extent under powers of attorney. I have said that really to try and manage this burgeoning online Internet world of assets with the current laws that we have on the books is like trying to regulate modern traffic with the rules of the road from the horse and buggy days. And that is the tension that really gives rise to what the Uniform Law Commission undertook with UFADA. And basically what that says in its biggest, in its broadest terms, it deals with the four scenarios that I mentioned. Estates of decedents that are subject to probate administration where you have a personal representative appointed. It also deals with trusts. That's important because, as Representative Barton mentioned, more and more the effort in estate planning is to get entirely away from wills and probate into trusts. That's where consumers are. That's where people who come in for estate planning are, moving out of probate wherever feasible to do so. Also, conservatorships is what UFADA addresses. And I think you heard one of the witnesses before refer to a huge imposition on autonomy, describing conservatorships. From a trust and estate attorney's perspective, a conservatorship is a critical means of managing the assets of a disabled individual so that they can be provided for while they remain disabled and alive, which in some cases can be years. So that while there may be an element of an imposition on autonomy, there understand that conservatorships are absolutely critical for providing for people who, by accident, by disease, whatever the cause may be, find themselves in a position where they're not dead. They don't have a personal representative or an estate. They may have a will, but it's not effective yet. They just don't have any means of managing their portfolio of assets, both traditional and in the Internet, and so rely on a court-appointed conservator to be able to do that for them. It's critical. And the other area that UFADA addresses, as I mentioned, is in power of attorney. As I say, to a lesser extent, because under UFADA, the power of attorney has to actually expressly grant authority over online assets and accounts. And so I think probably complies with the actual consent provisions of ECPA, just in what the UFADA requires for powers of attorney. So with that outline of UFADA, oh, and I should also mention that you, in terms of privacy, UFADA does recognize that privacy is a critical element to our online selves. In fact, Carl Szabo and several other representatives of the Internet service provider industry were observers on the drafting committee for UFADA for 2 years. Had prolific input, and much of it was listened to, obviously, because we have House Bill 2647 before you. They did not get what they wanted in all aspects of UFADA, but certainly they were in the room, and privacy was one of the issues that they raised. And one of the last amendments to UFADA says that basically when UVADA becomes effective, an internet service provider has to, in its practical terms, has to provide a checkbox, a yes or no, on the question of whether or not an account holder wants to have a fiduciary have access to that account information. And we're saying that it just can't be buried in the terms of service agreement. You need to ask that question explicitly, and UVADA does that. So a person could choose to allow access to by a fiduciary to certain accounts and could choose to elect not to allow. So there is that respect of privacy and an individual's wishes with particular as to particular accounts. So that said, that's the big picture of UFADA, and that's all I really want to say about it, except in response to questions that you may have. What I would say then is, as I mentioned and as Mr. Szabo said, House Bill 2647 was born out of that and was drafted by internet service providers and tech attorneys. Talk about a blind spot. I think what a blind spot in House Bill 2647 is that there were no trust and estate representatives attendant in the drafting of House Bill 2647. So while it has a very definite focus on privacy, and again, privacy is an important aspect of what we're talking about, it really does not have the representation of the people who on a day-to-day basis manage the work of conservators, personal representatives, trustees, and other fiduciaries. That's a critical omission from just the drafting of House Bill 2647. I want to finish here as fast as I can and leave time for my colleagues. And I think I've said pretty much what I need to say, knowing that they'll fill in the gaps that I've missed. What I would close with is just to suggest that if this was an Oregon-only bill that we were talking about today, I would encourage you to create a work group and get us all in the room and have us figure these things out. The fact is we're operating on a national level. We need uniformity in the states in terms of the approach to this. I do respect and am encouraged that certain providers, you heard about Facebook and Google, are moving in a direction that really is more like where UFADA was taking us, would take us in terms of policy, recognizing the importance of having access after death. But that's haphazard, and we don't have a uniform response to it in the industry today, and we're not likely to in the near future. We do need a uniform approach to this. So Oregon is not going to solve this in itself. What I would suggest to you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is if you are disinclined to adopt Senate Bill 369, the UFADA bill this session, if I say you being the legislature, I would strongly recommend that you simply take no action, not adopt this bill, and allow this conversation to continue on the national level as these issues get a further airing. As you heard from some of the witnesses, legislatures are grappling with this all over the country in this session. UFADA was just released by the Uniform Law Commission into this legislative session, this legislative year. It's a new conversation. You heard from the providers that their act has been adopted in one state. UFADA has been adopted in one state, in Delaware. At this point, it looks like there may be a lot of draws around the country between these two acts. And I would encourage you, if you are not inclined to adopt the more all-encompassing UFADA that deals with all of the assets in which fiduciaries have to be able to manage assets for an estate or for a protected person, then I would suggest that you simply stand down, allow that conversation to carry on for another couple of years, and see how things begin to move on a national basis and revisit this maybe when it's a riper conversation, if that's what you think we need to do. I would strongly encourage you not to adopt House Bill 2647 with its serious flaws and blind spots as it's been presented to you, even as amended. And with that, I will stop. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Shetterly.
Thank you.
Jeff, I think I'm going to go second.
Okay.
Thank you. Chair Parker, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Blatchley. I'm a trust and estate litigator. I have 18 years experience licensed in Washington and Oregon. I'm here today as part of the enactment team for the Uniform Law Commission. I've been an observer with them for the past 2 years. I was also the chair of the estate planning committee that we tried to enact legislation on this last year, and it was ultimately, we ultimately pulled it because the amendments from the online lobbyists came, and the final amendment was, okay, we'll give you this information unless the terms of service say otherwise. So we pulled it back because they said, why don't you wait until the Uniform Law Commission figures it out? So we're back here again because the Uniform Law Commission has figured it out. I'm also an executive member of the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Committee, and I'm also a commissioner, an appointed commissioner for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And the Governor's Commission on Senior Services opposes this bill and supports the UFATA bill. I'm here today to talk about how we can handle digital assets that are left behind when someone dies. While we believe this is an incredibly important issue, which I think we could all agree on, and that Oregon should pass legislation, we cannot support the industry proposal embodied in House Bill 2647, known as PEACE, and instead urge that Oregon join a growing list of states enacting the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, or UFATA. Now, I will admit that UFATA is not a very sexy name, and PEACE has privacy in it, so it's better marketing. So I will give that to the online providers, that they did a better job with marketing. So there are many different kinds of fiduciaries that need access to digital assets through online accounts. Personal representatives for when someone dies, power of attorney, when sometimes used for members like military leaving town, for the elderly as part of their estate plan, or ill people who need assistance in managing their affairs. So those are very important fiduciaries. And then also for trustees or for conservators when someone has been adjudicated incapacitated. Now, I do want to point out that UFATA is interesting in that the ACLU talked about conservators and the privacy issues. UFATA says that the default isn't that you get access. You have to go to the court and ask for access. So, but it's not difficult to imagine scenarios where you would need access. If somebody is being exposed to an online scam, you might need to have internet access to figure it out. You might be dealing with an incapacitated person that hasn't filed their tax returns for the last 4 years, and you need to go back and figure out where are all the accounts. Everything is online because there's this huge press right now to go paperless, which is great, good for the environment. But when everything goes into one account, like your Yahoo account, and the terms of service say Yahoo can delete that account when you die, how do you get that information? They hold all the cards. So it's an impossible situation. We agree that having a clear process for handling digital assets is important and that current law should be significantly improved upon. For example, if someone's will says, I want all of my Snapfish photos to be downloaded and given to the family I leave behind, a personal representative under current law would not be allowed to comply with that request because even if they had the password currently, that would be a cybercrime by using that password, which unfortunately Representative Fagan committed a cybercrime because you make a fraudulent representation to the end user that you are someone else. And you sit here and say, well, that's ridiculous. Of course it's ridiculous. That's why we're trying to get the law changed to say that fiduciaries who are special people governed by a well-established body of law in Oregon and all of our other fine sister states, these are special people. They're not just random people. There's a body of law that says what they can and cannot do. And that's the thing that's missing from what you heard from the proponents. This issue, this concept of privacy, and that fiduciaries are just going to blab everything they learn to everybody else. Fiduciaries every day get private, confidential information. Dad dies. Dad's a doctor. You're going through the files in his in the house. There's personal information about third parties. You don't share that information with anybody. You find out that somebody was an alcoholic. You don't share that information with anybody. Representative Fagan's testimony, she found out information about her mom that was troubling to her, but she didn't share that information with anybody. It's private. Fiduciaries are bound by confidentiality and to be prudent in what they do. So there's absolutely no reason to be concerned that they're going to broadcast this information, because if they do, there are consequences for that. You have a court action. You go after them. Unfortunately, there are many examples of digital assets that are valuable. So Amazon and Kindle allow books to be willed. Yet if you don't have authority to access them, then your hands are tied. Digital art exists. When someone dies, then is that not to be accessed? I'm certain the artists would disagree with that. Bitcoins are trading at $879 a Bitcoin. Without a fiduciary to have legal access to that, who gets that asset? How do you access accounts like PayPal? Do you just forfeit those accounts if you die? How do you know where the financial assets are if every single statement goes to Yahoo and then they have control over that with the delete button? House Bill 2647 does not adequately address these problems, in part because it relies on going through probate, a process which many people try to avoid, as you have pointed out already. It is expensive, labor-intensive, and doesn't address the problems that personal representatives encounter retrieving a decedent's property and returning it to the family. In fact, if you read through it, there are seven different legal hoops you need to jump through to get this order. And it increases the cost so much. In fact, we've talked, as a trust and estate litigator, I should be supporting this bill because it's going to be a whole heck of a lot more work for me. I'm going to be billing a lot more to the estates because it's just labor intensive. You have to convince the court that federal law, no possible federal law is going to be violated. So how do you talk to a state court judge about what federal law is when probate is a state animal? I can't go and file probate in federal court. It gets thrown out. They don't have any jurisdiction over that. So they're making it unnecessarily complicated in a way that legally it is not going to work. The other thing that the bill points out is that if somebody accesses an account after someone dies, they don't have to give you anything. So you're dealing with lay people who don't know about this law, and they have mom's password, and so they go in and access it. Well, and then the online providers find out about it later. They don't have to do anything. They get a out-of-jail-free card. They don't have to do anything because that's in the House bill before you right now, and it's a huge problem. Perhaps the biggest problem with House Bill 2647 is that it buys into the idea that large corporate online providers should control all the information and all the access. The bill provides that if the terms of service say they don't need to turn over the digital assets after a user dies, then they don't have to provide anything, regardless of what someone said in their will. It is cumbersome and unnatural extension of the law for many reasons. It's limited to personal representatives, so it's not dealing with trustees, power of attorney, and conservators. It codifies an unnecessarily expensive procedure. It punishes people who unwittingly access online accounts. It requires state courts to rule on federal laws. It requires personal representatives to know in advance of the account number and the specific identification of each account, which they likely will not know. And it reverses the normal process because even if they jump through these seven hoops, as has been identified, if the online providers come back and say, this is too hard, this seems like too much work, it's unduly burdensome. And I think that Representative Barton's question was very good, and I don't think the answer was very good of, well, we don't think the courts are ever really going to use that. Then why is it in there to begin with? Because it's their out, so they don't have to do anything. So in contrast, UFATA is being moved forward in about 20-plus states this year, and it has been an interesting battle. So in Oregon, Senate Bill 369 is substantially similar to the bill already adopted in Delaware. And when it was adopted in Delaware, the online providers, NetChoice in particular, Mr. Sazbo, who is here, is part of NetChoice, they sent an urgent letter to the governor asking it to be vetoed because the sky was falling. And it went forward, and everything seems to be going okay in Delaware so far. And other states are bound to come on board as well. It is not controversial, except that the online providers would prefer not to comply with it, and they are throwing a lot of lobbying dollars at it. Fiduciaries already have a lot of authority, bound and governed by well-established laws in every state. Extending that authority to online information is a natural extension of the law. It used to be that when someone died, the nominated personal representative would bring the will to their attorney and say, "What do I do now?" The attorney would provide advice, including that the PR should have all of the decedent's mail forwarded to the PR. So then you find out what the bills are, where the assets are, and you start to do your job as a fiduciary. Marshal the assets and distribute it pursuant to the terms of the will, right? And that's federal law. Federal law is dealing with the mail, but you can forward that as a personal representative because fiduciaries are held to a higher standard. But now with everything online, how do you do that? UFATA provides a predictable manner where a fiduciary, consistent with well-established fiduciary law, can deal with online accounts and assets. UFATA does not create new law, but rather allows fiduciaries and online providers to comply with the current law without inadvertent exposure to federal laws. So let's go back to ECBA, or the Stored Communications Act, this act that was enacted in 1986. So in online provider life, 1986 was about 3,000 years ago because things changed so quickly. And the Stored Communications Act was dealing with government intrusion of online activity. It does not talk about fiduciaries. Now, it would be wonderful if Congress would get together and look at this and say, you know what? We should just put in there that fiduciaries are authorized users because they are special creatures governed by law and they should have access to do their jobs. But holding our breath to have Congress to do that is not something that is really a time well spent. And again, probate is state law. It's not federal law. It's a policy decision. It's about choice. Do the citizens of Oregon want large corporations to decide what happens to their online accounts when they die or become incapacitated? Or do they want the freedom to plan and pick options for what happens to their online accounts? The ACLU Oregon has said, fundamentally, we believe that users should have the autonomy to control who can access their accounts after death, be that through account controls or in a formal will or estate plan. That's what UFATA does. That is not what the PEACE Act does, because the PEACE Act doesn't acknowledge that people are using trusts as part of their estate plan more and more every day. And there's a recent Gallup poll that just came out 5 days ago in the Business Journal, and it is about consumers doubt their personal information is very safe. Gallup polled more than 11,000 people, and the questions were how much trust they have in businesses and organizations to keep their personal information secure. And of the 12 different groups, the second one that they did trust, 91% said they had some or a lot of trust for, were banks. Banks did very well. I'm sure they would be happy to hear that. But who was at the very bottom of the list, lower than state government, trust for state government privacy, or federal government privacy? It was social networking websites or applications, 23%. So the idea that the online providers are going to keep things private is not supported by this recent Gallup poll. And the other really key issue is people who don't plan for their estate plans. So it's unfortunate that Mr. Sasbo is not leaving his wife with a will and a plan for what should be done, because then she's left in a situation where even if she does have his passwords to get access to find out what's going on with the accounts, again, that is a cybercrime by her using that password, and that simply cannot be. With UFATA, you choose what happens to your digital assets. Don't let companies dig your digital grave and bury your digital assets. The choice is clear, and the choice should be yours, or rather the choice of your constituents. UFATA honors the user's wishes for your online accounts and digital assets. And it's exciting that the online providers like Facebook are finally coming to the table. Legacy is just a few weeks old. But it could be that it's no different than when you have an investment account and you identify a beneficiary, so somebody gets that account when you die. You can do that with your online account. And if you do that, it passes outside of your estate. So the personal representative isn't going to have access to that. Maybe you have your social accounts that you want to go to somebody, and you want all your financial accounts to go to your personal representative. UFATA gives you those choices. And I see everybody's getting sleepy, so I will stop.
I just, before we go on, one of the problems, if everybody had a real fiduciary, I don't think we'd even be talking about this, but it's when somebody has their designates their goofy brother who then does share all the private information. And on the Gallup poll, the fact they don't trust, I'm guessing, I mean, just my thought, if I was asked that, I'd be thinking about Snowden's reports and the government going in and getting being able to go in and you know hack in and all that. That I think would be my concern, not that my provider would be. I mean, I'd be worried about somebody else attacking that.
And Chair Barker, I think that's the interesting thing about polls is everybody can find a statistic that they think helps their position. And even the poll that was cited by the proponents of this bill said that 70% of people want their information private or that the person they designate to have access. Well, that's the crux of the problem is that the majority of your constituents think that, well, if something happens to me and I haven't planned for it, somebody can put the pieces back together. Someone will get appointed, or my goofy brother will find a way to put all the pieces back together. But the truth of the matter is that unless you've sat down and done a comprehensive estate plan, you're going to be barred. So we have to have some defaults. And it's the same with having intestate. You have some defaults for what happens with your assets. So you're going to have some defaults for what happens to your online assets. Again, fiduciaries, when you are appointed as a personal representative, you have to decide what to do with this information. Maybe you decide, I don't even need to look at that. I'm just going to delete that. But identity theft is a huge issue in the United States. And particularly after people die, people are using Social Security numbers, date of birth. And so you have to have a way to go in and protect that. You know, shut down the PayPal account, shut down the credit cards. You have to have somebody who can manage all those things. So it's becoming a more complicated job for the personal representatives to do their job well. But under current law, they can't access anything. Even if they know there's, you know, Dad had an investment account. I don't know where it was, but I know he had an investment account. If everything is going online to an account that's been deleted because the terms of service say they can delete it, how are they ever going to find out where that money is? So it's the trail that they need to have access to. They don't want to go digging through all the personal information because that's not a good use of their time, and they have to do what is reasonably prudent. They don't have to unturn every single stone, but if there's something out there that's an asset, then they need to bring that into the fold.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Barker and members of the Judicial Committee, good afternoon. My name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an attorney with Samuels, Yole & Cantor. I'm the immediate past chair of the Estate Planning Administration Section, and I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2647. I'd like to say preliminarily I support Mr. Shetterly's comment to you that it probably makes sense for this these two bills to be tabled this session and move towards a work group because I think there are a lot of issues that need to be dealt with. And even this bill, 2647, still has quite a few blind spots. As Representative Barton pointed out, the movement these days in terms of, people are going paperless, but people are also choosing asset transfer methodologies that do not involve probate. And, for example, trustees, have been excluded under this bill, except there's a lot of estates, and I'm a trust and estate lawyer. I don't do litigation, but I do estate planning. I do estate administration. And we have trustees engaged in the administrative process without going through probate. Well, now they're going to have to step forward and file a probate process and proceeding to get access to the electronic information. And I think, one of the things that I'm concerned about the bill, and for that reason the Executive Committee opposes this bill of the estate planning section, is because it creates what appears to be some remedies, but they're kind of illusory in the sense that in order for after you've filed a petition for probate, now you've got to ask the court to make a finding that the disclosure that's being sought in the proceeding is would not violate the Stored Communications Act and other applicable federal law. Now, as you sit here today and look at the judiciary across the state of Oregon, that means every judge that has a probate calendar that they have to deal with now has to add these things to the calendar, and they must consider interpretation of federal law, which they're really not prepared to do. Now, maybe it would make sense, this bill might make more sense if there were a one court, sort of like, you know, a mini FISA court in a sense for the state of Oregon, where you could go to with somebody who's trained to look through these issues. But we have people who have done estate plans who have would prefer to avoid probate. Now we have to tell them that's not possible. And so I think the impact that this is creating on the Oregon judiciary to implement this bill is pretty burdensome and may in fact be very difficult to implement. Also from the state representative side, you've added another additional burden of going through the cost and effort and expense to do a probate, which heretofore they had been trying to avoid. And so this and then the other aspect too, which is the bill provides, at least if I understand all the Dash amendments, still requires that the personal representative indemnify the social media or the technical group, the communications group, from any damages that they incur from disclosure. And I think most fiduciaries or personal representatives are going to look at that and say, do I want to expose myself to that liability? I can't pass it off to anyone else. I really don't have enough assets to warrant that. And they may actually decide, after looking at this bill, to not go after the electronic data at all, because there just is too great a risk exposure. So there's other things that have largely been talked about, but I think it's our position that we oppose this bill. We recommend that it not be passed, and I think Lane Shetterly's suggestion for a study group or work group makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Actually, I have some questions. I just didn't want to. I feel like I'm hogging things. I'm sorry. I beg everyone's patience. Two questions for Mr. Shetterly, if I may. Just when you're taking off, I'm sorry, sir.
Sorry.
You know, I at the end of the day, you know, we can parse, you know, undue burden and other things, but really the crux of this issue, would you say that this is really a fairly legitimate policy choice between the default settings of privacy of electronic communications and for deceased people versus not? Like, what should the default be?
Yeah, Mr.
Isn't
Chair,
that a reasonable choice?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, that's an interesting way to pose the question, and I, frankly, I don't mind having you ask me. I know that our friends from Child Support Services are enjoying this tete-a-tete. It's an interesting way to posit the question, and it is at least one way to look at it. You have the House Bill 2647 that sort of sets the default at no disclosure, and it requires an election to disclose. UFADA takes just the different approach that the default is disclosure, subject to compliance with the conditions of UFADA, but always the ability of someone to say, under no circumstances do I want to have grant access. So there is an element of that dichotomy. It's a little more than that in 2647, in that, again, as we say, 2647 is woefully incomplete in what it covers in the way of fiduciary situations, trusts and conservatorships, but there is an element of that dichotomy that I would agree is one of the issues between these two approaches.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So taking, I guess, the other side of your argument, you raise a point that this is an evolving area of law. There seem to be these two approaches. I think you said that it's being fought to a draw and that different states are looking at this right now. We are just part of that pattern. Assuming that you would agree that it's a legitimate policy choice, is it really the end of the world if there are two approaches that are set of the state split between? I mean, we do that in the law often. In real estate, for example, recourse, non-recourse, state, community property, or other. There's a lot of areas where there's kind of two choices and the states are split because there are legitimate policy disagreements that reflect the values of the citizens. So, do you think this could be one of those, and is that a big problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I think it is a problem in this case, and that was one of the reasons that the Uniform Law Commission undertook this project in the first place. You know, a Uniform Law Commission looks at projects and takes on projects where uniformity is desirable among the states. And the difficulty here of a non-uniform approach is that we are dealing with internet service providers that provide these services on a national basis. I think difficult to have different pop-ups, for instance, come up in an account registration, depending on where the computer is that is gaining access. So I really do think that the fundamental decision of the Uniform Law Commission that this is an area of the law that really where uniformity is desirable and in fact almost essential is fundamentally accurate. And I would not suggest that this is a good issue for states to sort of establish themselves as independent laboratories. Let's see which approach works best. I think far better to try, if we have to work this out on a national basis first and then adopt, than to have this piecemeal approach between different states where you have UFADA in some, peace in some, or at least some version of UFADA, some version of peace, and then other states that have either something different or nothing at all. I think that's a chaos that probably doesn't advance anybody's interest.
May I follow up, Chair Barker? Thank you, Chair Barker. Representative Barton, I also wanted to say when as far as looking at the policy issue of it, is that UFADA is endorsed by the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and it is also endorsed by the American Bar Association, so they have about 410,000 members. So I wanted to point that out to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Grandma.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Novak, could you come up again? There's a question for you. Please. Pardon me?
I wanted to move this one.
We still have three bills we're trying to do, but that's okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Novak, I wanted you to respond to some of the discussion now that you've heard the testimony.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you for the opportunity to do that. First, I can assure you that permissive use of somebody's computer is not a cybercrime. The federal statute on this is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Permissive use is not a circumstance that triggers the act. I'd be hard-pressed to think of a prosecutor who would waste resources pursuing a claim against a spouse who is a permissive user of somebody's computer. That's a typical use case. I share every last personal computer in my house, for example, whether with one of my five children or my wife. The cause of action, by the way, under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is personal, and so would merge with the personal representative. So there would be a circularity there. UFADA has been rejected in five states already this year. The most recent was Virginia, and for lots of reasons. One, it turns the privacy expectation on its head. You have a presumption of blanket access, and you put the burden on the user to opt back into the protection that's been there under federal law for almost 30 years. And that same expectation is memorialized in our privacy policy as well as the other people in our industry space. Another reason is, frankly, if fiduciaries were all bound to preserve the confidentiality of a decedent's communications, and you're right, for most people, including myself, I've been a lawyer for 25 years, I think. If they were bound, and my wife will be my personal representative, if she chooses not to serve, I suppose it will be one of my children. But if they were bound to preserve the confidentiality of decedent's communications, we wouldn't be reading these awful stories about the sale of Jackie Onassis's private correspondence to a priest. The reality of this, I think, is that not all conservatorships, guardianships, or powers of attorneys are the same. They're highly fact-specific. I did trust in estate litigation when I was in private practice. I had circumstances where I had to get a guardian appointed for a client who lost competency. There are significant differences in a court supervisory jurisdiction with regard to a power of attorney or whether you have a trust or a conservatorship or a guardian ad litem. These are all issues that we think ought to be addressed. For example, some jurisdictions have enacted the Uniform Powers of Attorney Act, and the view is if there's need of clarification or some additional power there, that's something that ought to be taken up in that chapter of that state's code. I think the short of it is what we are aiming to do is not to impose additional burden on an estate here. What we ended up with in Virginia, for example, is something that squares perfectly with existing probate practice in Virginia. You would simply go into the clerk's office. You would have the clerk issue an order upon attestation, same as they do with getting a certificate of qualification.
And that's an order that the Virginia Supreme Court is going to work with us on. So it'll be standard across all the circuit courts across the Commonwealth. We'll socialize that form with everybody in our industry space. Everybody will know exactly what to expect and how to handle those forms. So the aim here is not to require an elderly widow, for example, to hire a lawyer to conduct a hearing to do all of this, but rather to have a very streamlined process that still ensures that we protect the expectations of the decedent, and not just the decedent, but the people with whom the decedent communicated. That's a significant issue to us. It's a matter of user trust. It's a matter of federal law.
I have a question. I mean, okay, so Jeff, I'm just curious. So you mentioned that there's five other states right now that have rejected UFATA. And I'm looking at the internet, and I see that there are 22 states currently, or earlier this year, have been doing something with legislation. Do you know how many of those have passed already with staying true to what the policies are from UFATA?
The only action this year, one way or another, whether on peace or UFATA, is in Virginia. And again, in Virginia, UFATA was defeated in the House, and the Peace Act passed on unanimous votes in both houses. That's the only final action on the Peace Act. UFATA has died in committee, and Mr. Sabo has a better memory for me on this, but Maryland, Virginia, there we go, Mississippi, North Dakota, and Wyoming.
Can you just follow up?
Sure, please.
Okay, thanks. Since you've been described as the old guy in
it's okay.
business, I mean, it would seem to me that you'd want some consistent policy.
Yeah, as a general matter, look, we prefer uniformity to patchwork, obviously. I have five people who manage this full-time for me, and this is everything we get from whether it's FISA court or local law enforcement, whatever. We don't look to add complexity to that. The structure of the Peace Act basically preserves the status quo, in that there's a presumption of privacy of those communications unless somebody comes to us. In Virginia, for example, it will be a form that we'll recognize because we will have worked on the form with the Virginia Supreme Court, and that form will reflect that there was an election, whether through a will or something somebody's done with a service provider, in order to get that content. Or, absent that, it'll be a standard production of envelope information. This is easy enough to manage. I think the difficulty we run into with UFATA is, again, things are very different. Not all conservatorships, not all guardianships are the same. We're not interested, frankly, in getting sort of behind the process. We're not equipped to do that. I mentioned when I testified earlier, one of the reported cases we've got in this area involved a New England Police Department that submitted to our warrant line what purported to be a warrant. And it turned out that it was something that was never presented to a court. And so Judge Ellis in the Eastern District of Virginia said, you're out of luck. You violated ECPA because it wasn't actually processed. And therefore, we couldn't avail ourselves of the good faith defense. So obviously, we don't look to get behind that process. I can tell you that I've implemented a couple of safeguards here to ensure that we don't get duped in that way again. But it happens. We've had naval investigators who've lied to us. We've had other social engineers. We have lots of people who are interested in those communications of our users. And obviously, as I said, every one of those contacts we get, whether it's in a call center or whether it's through my compliance team, every one of those is a lawsuit in the offing if we get it wrong.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time and consideration.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2647. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3156.
Chair Barker, member of the committee. This House Bill 3156 is a House Judiciary Committee bill, but the concept comes to us from the Department of Justice. We are talking today about child support orders on the next three bills. If a child support order is terminated due to a change in the custody of a child, such as one child going to live permanently with a different parent, the Department of Justice may suspend enforcement of the support order if collection of the support order would cause an imbalance between the obligee and the obligor. The person who would be receiving the payments has 14 days in which to object, and can only object based on the physical custody of the children or the creation of a credit imbalance. House Bill 3156 removes the requirement that collection would create a credit imbalance and that the obligee not object to the suspension. But we do have the proposed dash one amendments which restore the requirement that collection would result in a credit imbalance and includes provisions that collection of child support may be suspended upon a change in custody if collection would impair the ability of the obligor with custody of the children to provide support for such children. It is not ready to move today because we are still waiting for the fiscal.
Okay, thank you. Kate Cooper Richardson and Michael Ritchie. And we'll, I'll open, how about the next one? And also open House Bill 3158.
Certainly. Chair Barker, again, on child support orders. This one deals with Chapter 416 and Chapter 25, and it deals with multiple child support judgments. House Bill 3158 repeals a requirement that later issued child support judgments must be entered before January 1st, 2014 in order to take precedence over other issued orders.
And how about
3159 is a very similar measure. And it deals with the creation of a debt when a check is dishonored. Currently, the department must attempt to recover the debt if it's cost effective, and this changes the structure for when a third party pays that debt.
Thank you, Vera. Okay, just have everybody up to sign up for the three bills. So thank you. You go in any order again, please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. So 3156 first?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm the director of the Oregon Child Support Program and the division administrator at the Division of Child Support at the Department of Justice. We're here today with three little child support bills, and they seem very small now after listening to the very big issues you've been dealing with. But they are important to the efficiency of our program. And I will say right off the bat that there is no known opposition to this. You have my testimony, I think, already before you. House Bill 3156 will allow the court and the child support program to suspend enforcement when, during the course of a pending legal action, when all the children have begun residing with a parent who was ordered to pay support. This is an operation of fairness, and I just want to put out that we'll stand on our written testimony here in the interest of time, unless you would like to ask some questions.
Anybody else on this? Mike, do you want to talk to this bill, too? Or?
Chair Barker, member of the committee, I was here to answer the technical questions, and if there are none, then I don't have anything I need to add.
Okay, great. Okay, so we can go on to the next bill then as well, 3158.
I just want to verify this happens when the child or the children are all in the custody of the obligator. Is that right?
So this situation addresses when the obligor, that's the person obligated to pay support, has ended up with all the children back in his or her care, and it still takes time for a modification to go through the process, but during the pending legal action, this would allow the court or the child support program, under certain circumstances and subject to objection, to suspend enforcement of the support.
Thank you.
So an example would be summer vacation, dad takes the kids for the summer. The mother's had them, he's paid child support, but now he's got full custody of them for some time period. But something like that, is that what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, this goes to a more permanent situation, and Mike, I heard you start to say something, so I'll let you finish.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ritchie. I work as the general counsel for the child support program. That could be the basis on which we'd be doing this, but very typically parenting time agreements provide for some custody with the paying parent during the summer. So the reason I hesitate in just completely embracing what you just said is that very often that's already built in, and that if it's built into the parenting time agreement, it would not be the basis for a modification. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and on to the next bill. That's the
general counsel, I think, of the DOJ, is my understanding.
Very well. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kate Cooper Richardson, Director of the Oregon Child Support Program and Division Administrator for the Division of Child Support at the Department of Justice. I'm here on House Bill 3158 today. You have my testimony in front of you, but this is a fix on a fix, I think, to say it shortly. This would allow, and you would think this would already be the case, but the Child Support Program, the courts to treat a later issue court judgment as superseding the support provisions of an earlier entered earlier issued administrative order. And this goes back to talk about current law only allows the later issued judgment to supersede if it was entered before January 1st, 2004. We thought this issue had already been fixed, but surprise, surprise, more issues, more of these cases floated to the service. We're happy to ask or answer any questions. I'm not going to ask any.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. How much of a problem is this?
Well, it's popped up recently, or in the last couple of years, as a problem with the court. Do you want to go ahead and try that?
I'd be glad to, Chair Barker, members of the committee. In 2004, when the governing child support process went into effect, we had what, in retrospect, was a completely sort of unjustified expectations that we'd fix the problem and this wasn't going to continue happening, and we only needed to take care of the previous orders, which is why the law now only applies for the pre-2004 orders. Well, with the benefit of 14 years of experience, we realize that this is, or 10 years of experience, we realize this is continuing to come up. So this is a fairly frequent occurrence. It happens with quite a bit of regularity. Parties at some point, whether they go on public assistance and we get a mandatory referral from DHS, which causes us to establish an order, or they file an application for services, we'll get an administrative order on the books and begin enforcing it. They will subsequently pursue their divorce and either unintentionally check the boxes that say they want child support, or they'll deliberately ask for it and neglect to tell the court that there is a pre-existing administrative order. So the court enters an order that does not take into account that there's this pre-existing order, and you end up with two orders or three orders or four orders. We've had cases where they've gone to several counties as they've moved and modified their orders or established new orders, and we end up having to engage in this process. This bill aims to fix the most simple elementary one, which is there's an administrative order, then the parties go to court, and most often to get divorced, enter a court order that has child support in it, and this will just allow us to treat that as superseding our order, even if the court forgets to say those magic words.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to 3159.
Very well. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm still Kate Richardson. I'm the Director of the Child Support Program and Division Administrator for the Division of Child Support at the Department of Justice. House Bill 3159, and I believe you have a couple of amendments with you. The dash twos, only the dash twos because they incorporated the dash ones. And those are our amendments, by the way. It amends ORS 25125 to permit Oregon to recover from anyone who issues a check as payment for a child support obligation when that check has been dishonored after it's been disbursed. Right now, we can only go after the the obligor and the employer, for instance, or the withholder if they've withheld money. But this would also allow us to recover from a third-party issuer. And that happens pretty often in that grandma or someone comes along and pays on the behalf of somebody else, but then their check is dishonored. And it's difficult sometimes to recover when you when you can only go after the obligor in the first place. So this bill would clean that up by adding an extra provision to allow us in the cases of child support payments to go after the issuer of the check as well. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Very well.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3156, 3158, and 3159.
Thank you.
This is coming before the committee. Stay.